Folks, Field of Greens is the healthiest thing I do every day, and I want you on this journey with me. Why? It's literally one scoop a day. It tastes great. I love the fruit flavors particularly, and it's completely improved my life and my health. This is nutrition the way nature intended. When I began taking a hard look at why I wasn't feeling good and why I felt unhealthy, why I was gaining weight, why I was losing energy, it wasn't just because I had hit my 50s. No, it was because I wasn't getting the right amount of fruit and vegetables in my diet. And listen, I'm just too busy to go to the store, clean up the vegetables, cook vegetable dinners, and make sure I hit the fruit. A Field of Greens stepped in. One scoop of powder in my drink or on my eggs in the morning, and boom, I was off and feeling better. And suddenly, I was losing weight. I was sleeping better. My metabolism went up. My blood sugar went down. My cholesterol went down, and my weight went down. And my doctor said, hey, whatever you're doing, keep it doing. You know what that is? It's Field of Greens. That's what I've been doing. Field of Greens is radically different. Each organic fruit and vegetable was medically chosen to support heart and vital organ health. I trust Field of Greens to keep me healthy. I promise you, you're going to love this product. But if for any reason you don't, they'll give you 100% money back guarantee. Now, you're going to get 15% off your first order, plus free rush shipping because of the incredible partnership we have here at Just the News with Brick House Nutrition, and of course, Field of Greens. All you got to do to take advantage of this offer, visit fieldofgreens.com and use the promo code JustNews. That's promo code JustNews at fieldofgreens.com. Don't wait. Go to fieldofgreens.com today. Use the promo code JustNews for 15% off. Hello, America, and welcome to a new edition of John Solomon Reports, the podcast from Just the News, where so much is going on today. But we're going to bring in two of our very best reporters. Daniel Payne and Greg Piper have been covering some of the biggest stories that really are defining American culture today. Some people say it's a culture war. It's certainly a robust debate about what sort of education we're going to teach our children and what the curricula is. What are the lines of fact-checking? What are the lines of debate in America? What are the proper and improper approaches to censorship, particularly in the big tech world? But one could argue in all forms, what are the rights of due process? If we are going to challenge someone, accuse them of something, say that their information is wrong or offensive, what due process is in place? And these two great reporters, Daniel Payne, Greg Piper, are covering these stories day in and day out. And I thought it would be fun today. We'll break away from the breaking news. There's a lot of it. Go to justthenews.com, check it out. But really take a look and see what it is that we're doing from these two great reporters. Every day they're building a narrative. They're building stories. They're helping you get facts that you can then make your decision. That you can download the court rulings they're writing about. You can get the documents, the emails of Fauci to see the effort to have a narrative in America that may not have been accurate or complete or fully baked when it was imposed on us. These two great reporters are doing amazing work on, I think, some of the most issue-defining stories that we have at Just the News right now. Freedom versus conformity, freedom versus government, freedom versus big tech, freedom versus due process. Very important issues that are all playing themselves out on the world stage and then on the national stage. And these two guys, Greg Piper, Daniel Payne, are right there in the front seat covering it for you, giving you the facts so you can make up their mind. We're going to spend the whole show with them. I'll mention one thing real quickly in the breaking news front because you're going to not want to miss this story. You're going to want to read this story. Just a little bit ago, as we were getting ready to do the show, the Inspector General for the Park Police, the Department of Interior, Inspector General, they oversee the Park Police. They resolved through investigation a very, very big issue. If you remember last summer, about a year ago this time, Donald Trump was walking over to a church across the White House property to go hold up a Bible and give a speech or make some comments during the height of the Black Lives Matter protests and the outrage in America over George Floyd's death. And the police took some action to repel the protesters, including deploying some tear gas. And immediately the news media said, Donald Trump forced them to do that. This was all about Donald Trump. It was a complete abuse of power. We can go through, you can look at all of the articles. Well, guess what the Inspector General ultimately concluded? A pretty interesting thing. They concluded that Donald Trump and his decision to make that appearance at Lafayette Square had nothing to do with the police actions. Had nothing. It wasn't about Donald Trump. Police had made these strategic decisions of how they were going to clear the lot, how they were going to deal with the protesters, independent of any decision by President Trump to cross into Lafayette Square, make this comments in front of the famous church. Now go back and look at all the stories at the time, the CNNs, the Washington Post, the New York Times, and see how wrong, how one-sided, how assumptive, presumptive those stories were. They were wrong stories, and it is an enormous opportunity for us to take a moment of inflection and realize that we, lately, in the era of Trump, maybe going back to 2015, the news media kept jumping into preconceived narratives, biases, and through a lack of neutral reporting, they misled you. They didn't wait for the facts to come out. Sometimes they ignored the facts. They contorted the facts, and they gave you stories and forced you to try to believe them. And let me go through them. Donald Trump engaged in Russia collusion. No, he didn't. Russians put bounties on the head of American soldiers in Afghanistan, and the Trump administration didn't care. Nope, that didn't happen. Turned out to be disinformation, misinformation. Donald Trump forced the Park Police to crack down on protesters so he could go have a political photo op. No, according to the Inspector General today, he did not. We can go through many, many more. There's no way Donald Trump's going to have a vaccine. It's a pipe dream. He had a vaccine before he left office. On and on again, our news media, my profession, let you down by abandoning neutrality for political agendaism. And in the end, you were fed once again, one story after another story after another story that were wrong, misleading, a disservice to the public interest, which is not what journalism is for. And listen, journalism still does great things. I don't agree with my friend Sean Hannity that journalism's dead. I committed journalism. That's how we unraveled the Russia scandal. I committed journalism, and that's how we brought to light the Hunter Biden scandal. The Washington Post has done great work on certain things, but they've disserved us on others. ProPublica, a left-leaning news organization, did a very great, important public service the other day by informing America about how many of the liberal billionaires who support large taxes, they themselves did not pay taxes. They had complete tax avoidance, sometimes for years and decades at a time. And we're talking about Bloomberg's and Bezos's and those sort of big, iconic oligarchs on the left. Yes, a left-leaning organization exposed their tax avoidance. Journalism is still important. It still can serve the public interest, but it can't serve the public interest if the practitioners insist on creating a political outcome and ignoring the facts, the omission of facts, and neutrality. You got to just have a neutral voice. Put the facts out there, acknowledge what you can know, what you don't know, and let the American people make up their mind and stop putting a ring in our nose and trying to lead us around. It disserves us, and we got a lot of falsehoods as a result of that approach. That's the one thing I want to point out, because this story today with the Capitol Police, Park Police review, the Inspector General's review on the Interior Department, clearly exposes another major false media narrative. Very scary. All right, folks, we're going to get a commercial break. When we come back, two great Just the News reporters, Greg Piper and Daniel Payne. You're not going to want to miss discussion, culture and censorship in America. What's the real story? What are the real facts? You're going to get it right after this commercial break. Hey, folks, as we approach another critical election, a wave of concern washes over America. Recent studies reveal that an astonishing 56% of our fellow citizens report feelings of anxiety or dread about the upcoming presidential election. That's why I stand with AMAC. AMAC is more than a senior discount organization. During these challenging times, they fight for common sense and hope that our nation returns to traditional American values. Visit amac.us/justnews today to seize an exclusive election year special, a 4-year AMAC membership for just $30. That's right. You heard me right. 4 years for $30. As an AMAC member, you're not only enjoying money-saving benefits, but also the AMAC magazine, free Social Security and Medicare advice, a trusted voice in Washington, and a community of like-minded patriots who love this great nation. Take advantage of this election year special. 4 years for $30, and be part of the solution over the next 4 years. By becoming an AMAC member, you're strengthening a movement dedicated to preserving the principles we hold dear in this great country. country. Join now at amac.us/justnews. That's amac.us/justnews. All right, folks, welcome back from the commercial break. And as promised, two very special, very talented reporters are joining me from Just the News. You've seen their bylines. You've read their stories. Sometimes their stories might have even made you mad. Sometimes I read their story, I can't believe this is going on in America. But joining us right now is Daniel Payne and Greg Piper. Gentlemen, welcome to the show.
Good to be here, John. Thanks.
Thanks, John.
It's an honor to have both of you on. Daniel was with us from the start. Greg joined us a couple of months ago, but both are having enormous impact. And, you know, I've been stepping back for a second trying to figure out, you know, what is it that we've been covering at Just the News? What are the big stories? And I think the biggest story is that there's a battle over the culture and mores of America going on. That's really what it is. We can call it politics and we can call it policy, but there's a bigger question of what America we're going to be and what America we're going to teach our children to respect, learn, or disrespect. And a lot of it comes down to, you know, a difference between the 1776 Commission and the 1619 Project, but it's manifesting itself in so many ways. We have professors being fired for expressing personal opinion, teachers being fired, big ruling yesterday. We've got professional journalists, Just the News among them, that have written factually accurate stories that were censored for a long time, only to recently be reversed in the COVID-19. And I think this question of freedom of speech, freedom of religion, is really gaining attraction, and it's sort of a fulcrum battle in America. And so I want to see if you guys, because you've been covering it great, and there, I want to bring people up to speed on not only the news events that have happened, but the bigger ideology and bigger battle that for the soul of America that's going on. So let me start with you, Greg. You had a pretty important court ruling you covered yesterday. A teacher in Loudoun County, suburban Washington, D.C., was suspended and on his way to being fired for raising concerns about gender-neutral pronouns, and the court intervened yesterday. Tell us what happened with the court.
So this is a ruling that was brought on an emergency basis. There was a hearing Friday night that dragged on for quite a while, going over what to do about this teacher who had been suspended very quickly after he spoke at a public school board meeting at the invitation of the school board, which is seeking public comment on his opposition to the policy they were considering on requiring teachers and staff to use students' preferred pronouns if they're transgender students using pronouns that you would not ordinarily use for them.
Right.
And also letting them compete on sports teams of the opposite sex. He shared his view as a Christian and as someone who had learned a little bit about students who had detransitioned from transgender identities, that he did not want to follow this policy. He thought it was bad. He thought it was child abuse. This is the term he used. He only spoke for a minute, and he was done. The school district the next day started getting some angry emails from a few families saying they didn't want their kids to be anywhere around him. He's a gym teacher. And by that night he was suspended. And so he brought suit very quickly. And the emergency hearing was scheduled quickly, and the parties got to go over this and find out did he actually cause, as the school district claimed, a substantial disruption that justified his suspension.
Wow. So for just expressing his religious belief at a school board meeting, he wasn't there in his capacity as a teacher. I think he was there as his capacity as a parent. Is that correct?
He was speaking as an individual, is how his lawyers phrased it.
Yeah.
He was not there as a teacher. This was not during school hours. He's just an interested person in the community.
Wow. Pretty remarkable. And so the court has, for the time being, sided with the teacher, correct? He can't be terminated at this point.
Exactly. The court required the school to reinstate him through the end of the year, actually. He'll get to finish out this school year and then at least part of next school year. While his case goes forward on the merits. But the court suggested he's likely to win if the school board actually wants to go to court on this, actually wants to have a full trial on this, because he was speaking on a matter of public concern that was in his individual capacity. And the judge had said the school district jumped forward from him expressing his views about this policy to essentially saying that he would violate the policy. They leaped ahead, as the court said, when they hadn't actually gotten to that point yet. So there could be further arguments down the line if a student were to file a complaint against this teacher. that this could actually go to a different factual place. But at the moment, simply expressing his opposition is considered to be trampling on his First Amendment rights. And the court said also chilling the speech of other teachers. Some of them filed declarations saying they avoided speaking up because they saw how he was treated and they refer to being treated the same way.
Wow. Pretty powerful. Amazing that in this country of free speech, that someone just expressing their political views in a forum where they're, by the way, they're supposed to be solicited. People were invited to come to this forum, that it could come at the cost of your job. And it looks like the courts are there. Because this was an emergency order, I guess the court had a rule on the likelihood that he might prevail. And so they've sort of tipped their hand that as this case winds its way through, he has a good chance of prevailing is sort of the court's philosophy. Is that correct?
It looks that way. As this actually goes into further briefing, there could be an issue here over whether the school is kind of painted in a corner because they claim they're following state law. They're required to be developing these plans that that address how to treat students who are transgender, who are gender expansive, I think is actually one of the terms they used in there. It was kind of an odd term to see in their filing. And so this has a little bit of a further issue of is the state forcing school districts to do something that potentially could infringe on First Amendment rights, especially could hit teachers and staff, and claim they don't get to have First Amendment rights because they are employees of the government and they are speaking as employees.
Wow. Pretty, that's going to be a pretty epic case. That's going to probably turn out to be a landmark case if the parties decide to take it all the way through. The battle here is over. There is a legitimate dispute over ideas in America. And Danny, you've done a lot of great work on this, covering this. There are, you know, the Trump Commission, the 1776 Commission, which said we should teach more patriotic historical facts to Americans and recognize that this is a great country. With it added flaws. Yes, we had slavery. We made mistakes. We've had bad moments in our history. But that in general, America is a good country based on good values and a good governing system. And then there's this new and emerging doctrines, and they have lots of different components to it. One is called critical race theory, kind of rooted in the 1619 project, that by definition, America is a inherently racist country. And if you're white, you're inherently racist. Those are some of the precepts of this philosophy. And, you redefine historical events like the Revolutionary War. The Revolutionary War was really fought to preserve America's right to keep slaves in America as opposed to win freedom from the oppressive King George. And then the second component is there's some of the as Greg just so artfully described, there are these disputes over transgender students. Should biological boys be allowed to compete against biological against girls by just claiming that they were transgender, and should a teacher or fellow students be required to address a biological male as she or a biological female as he if they choose to identify their gender differently than their biological composition? There is a debate in America. There are people who don't think this is the right way to go. There are people who think this is a good way to go. How is this playing out in the school districts and in the colleges across our country?
Yeah, I think that the most salient feature of the debate as it exists today is just how lopsided it is in the sense of kind of who wields the power. There is a significant and growing backlash to many elements of critical race theory, of transgender ideology. It's coming from parents who are disturbed what's being taught to their kids. It's coming from kids who are upset with what they're being taught and the way that schools are being organized. But that kind of backlash is coming after really several decades of aggressive and sustained implementation of these ideologies in these educational institutions. So when parents find out, for instance, that their kids are being taught white people are the only ones that can be racist, and all whites in America are racist, and that if you refer to a male as he instead of she, regardless of how they want to identify, then you're this horrible bigot. There's a lot of people who are realizing that this sort of thing is being taught, but these institutions have been largely shaped by those ideas, over the last 10 or 20 or even 30 years. So I think that's what a lot of people who are opposed to these systems of thought are finding, and they're finding it out the hard way, which is that, as that teacher found out briefly, if you do speak up in opposition to these ideas, if you do speak up on the basis of religious beliefs or philosophical beliefs or just practical beliefs, you may find yourself out of a job. You may find yourself completely immiserated and shunned by your peers. Parents can find themselves utterly cast out of parent groups, you know, and friend groups. So the fight is getting heated, and there's ever more pressure from all sides to kind of resolve this one way or the other. But as for who kind of holds the keys to power right now in this debate, it really is the folks you know who are controlling these institutions and have spent the last several decades really molding you know these aspects of American life to that image. So there's definitely sort of an asymmetry of power there that we're seeing play out every single day.
And this struggle is really playing out in the form of censorship. We just talked about the teacher who went to a school board meeting where, by the way, views were solicited, and he gave his view, and then he almost lost his job and had to go to court. Greg, you had a story the other day that where a suburban Detroit school district was trying to censor a student's graduation speech, a valedictorian speech, because they thought it was too Christian. And they claimed in the filings that they had a pedagogical, if I said that right, pedagogical interest.
Pedagogical.
Yes, thank you. Interest in protecting students from this particular student's view. I'm curious, where is this playing out? Where are this idea that that schools are sort of now the referee of all things speech? Are you seeing this as a pattern now? Is it becoming larger, more widespread?
Oh yeah, I would definitely say so. Part of this is simply that we have social media now. Schools have been frankly terrified by social media because now they see potential disruptions and threats to kind of the orderly classroom environment and safety at school coming from all over the place, from stuff that is not actually said when students are there. And so there's really a greater concern about that. As far as graduation speeches go, this one actually goes back quite a ways further. In this particular case, and in another one that actually happened in Michigan around the same time, you had students who were specifically chosen to give either graduation speeches or something pretty close to it. One of them was called an honor ceremony for basically academic achievement. And the students really wanted to speak about their faith. They went into some detail about it. It wasn't simply my faith is important to me, but actually using specific Christian language, calling for other people to repent. It was not something that was conveyed in a kind of a hostile way, but just as anybody who's proselytizing would do in kind of a friendly on the street kind of way, or
right,
you know, talking to somebody personally. And this kind of stuff definitely can trigger principals. They are very mindful of drawing attention, especially from groups that want to stamp religion out of public life, that want to enforce secularism. And these legal battles have gone on over the past at least two decades. They were going on when I was in high school. So you basically have very reticent school districts that want to try to keep these references as generic as possible and pretty minimal. And in this particular case in the suburban Detroit school district, the principal said, you're talking basically on behalf of us. You're speaking on behalf of us. You're speaking in an academic context here. You're making references that are not actually related to the purpose of this, and so we actually get to control your speech. It was fairly explicit in what this principal was saying. And the student very quickly got legal counsel, and they pushed back and said, no, there's actually a long history of case law in this. There's actually Department of Education guidance on this that you appear to be violating by claiming that this is actually school speech that she is saying.
Wow, that's a pretty big deal. And the student prevailed in that case, right, at the end?
Yes, indeed. The student prevailed there. The other Michigan school district that kind of went through the same thing had a different response, actually. They said, we'll make a one-time exception for you to do this. But we contend that we are correctly following legal case law on this and that we can control what you say in the interest of, because of our pedagogical interest.
Remarkable. I mean, these are pretty remarkable claims. And, you know, the one thing that early seems to be a pattern is that the predominance of the court ruling so far have really supported individuals' right to free speech over the government's ability to censor it under some protective guise or protective intention, even if it was a good intention. Is that a fair assessment of the early court rulings? They seem to be tipping in favor of the individual's free speech rights. Is that a good read of that?
It's a little difficult to say. On the federal level, I would say the case law is fairly well settled. At least if you have students who are speaking in certain venues where there's actually pretty clear precedent on it. This is a little more complicated when you get into students who are, let's say, speaking in a student newspaper or a student radio station,
right?
Or who are trying to express themselves in ways that may provoke reasonable expectation of causing an actual disruption. So there's some Supreme Court cases on here that go back to the 1970s, but also the 1980s. On what constitutional rights students have in the classroom, on school grounds. The early one from the Vietnam War era basically says unless there's a substantial disruption that actually looks like it's really going to happen, not just you're afraid it might happen, but you have a reason to believe it will happen. Unless that happens, you can't censor what students are saying in the classroom or in the hallways. There's a different precedent from the 1980s where the court said, in school-sponsored activities like a student newspaper, you can actually exercise a lot of censorship. That was one that concerned a lot of advocates for students' First Amendment rights. There's a Supreme Court case right now that is testing the limits of this case law to see can schools actually clamp down on what students do when they're not in school, when they're not in school-sponsored activities, when they're on social media. That will be an enormous ruling when it comes out. The court, when it heard oral arguments this spring, sounded a little skeptical of extending this authorization of police student speech, but you never know what it's actually going to turn out as. It may be a limited ruling. That will be very big for what rights students have in the classroom.
Yeah, it really is. These are epic free speech cases that I think will define a generation of free speech, depending where America and the courts come down. And I think it's really fascinating. That's why it's so important. The great work that each of you do every day, you're on top of these stories day and night. We hardly miss one. We're on top of them all, and I'm really, really proud of that. Daniel, one of the things that we're starting to see in this debate is that there's an argument, and Bill Barr, the Attorney General, made this in a speech he gave. It was quite a remarkable speech down in Florida a couple of weeks ago, where he suggested that what's really going on in these particularly urban blue school districts is an effort to make secularism a religion that they impose on children, which is the only way you can go to school and learn is if you believe in secularism, that it's okay for a person to determine their transgenderism, that it's your religious matters, your religious values must be suppressed to the idea that America is a racist country. And you can go through all the different ways. And he suggested that someone soon will likely bring a lawsuit challenging these school curricula as an infringement on the right of a parent to choose the faith of their children, that they're so anti-Christian that the secularism is in and of itself a faith, and the government may not, under the Establishment Clause, teach or impose a certain faith value system. Do you see that coming on the horizon? Are there people in the lawyers and school districts and other places that you've been talking to who see that at some point this is going to be called state-sponsored secularism? And there may be an epic lawsuit challenging it.
You know, to me, it kind of seems like a long shot in one sense, just as because you could imagine some pretty sophisticated arguments that these people would deploy in defense of this kind of curriculum. These are not dumb people after a fashion, as bizarre as many of their ideas seem. It's possible to mount a wide variety of defenses against all sorts of criticism of this stuff. I mean, U.S. courts have historically taken a pretty stringent view against state religions, particularly after the middle of the 19th century. That's been something that that courts have been pretty strict on as far as what governments may allow. Whether or not even something is aggressively secular and so often hostile to traditional religious and particularly traditional Christian beliefs would itself qualify as a religion will be that would be an argument that would have to come with a large amount of finesse to be able to make it conform, I think, to U.S. case law and to the opinions of judges. So it would not surprise me at all if that argument is mounted at some point in the near future. And if there isn't a decent case to be made for it, that religious students and religious parents are at a particular disadvantage and at a particular risk for discrimination, at the very least in public school systems. But whether or not that kind of case ultimately succeeds will be both up to the judges and to the people who are making the argument itself.
One of the constitutional questions that are also coming up in the culture war, but culture cases, is the right to due process. And Greg, you had a really great story the other day taking a look at one of Barack Obama's key civil rights appointees, Catherine Lehman, and the fact that in her prior role in the Obama administration, she regularly advocated for colleges to adopt these new procedures for sexual harassment and sexual assault cases on college campuses. Now, sexual assault is a serious problem on college campuses. This is people have described it as an epidemic. But one of the concerns of the approach that Lehman and the Obama administration created and tried to impose through its federal fiat was that the accused, the often male students, but it could be a female student as well, accused of sexual assault, didn't have the due process rights, that it was sort of a mob mentality that led to expulsions before evidence and due process had made its way through. And what you pointed out was that most of the, they may have been well-intentioned, but Lehman's recommendations and urgings and policies have on review by the courts been overturned. And it seems as though the courts have taken not only a suspicious eye to some of these efforts to squelch free speech in students, but also to preclude the right of students in college to defend themselves and to have a due process their day in court when they're accused of sexual assault. Where the courts have been pretty tough on the Lehman approach to this sexual assault crisis that the government's been trying to resolve for years. Is that a good way of looking at it?
Yeah, this was something of a surprise nomination because Catherine Lehman, her track record of the policies she pushed at the Department of Education many years ago, have not done well in court in the past few years. It hasn't been the departments that suffered. It's been the colleges that implemented these policies that oftentimes would not let students cross-examine their accuser even indirectly. Through maybe an attorney. Students were often not allowed to have lawyers involved in any way. They may not even know what the accusations against them are. There's a problem in these proceedings to try to withhold a lot of information from the accused students to make it actually hard for them to defend themselves. And for the schools especially to say, we actually don't owe you really much in the way of due process. We've told you generally what you're accused of. We've given you an opportunity to respond, that's it. In the litigation that's followed this over the past probably 5 to 6 years, it started slowly, but it kind of snowballed up, and now you have actually a pretty big record of court decisions that tell schools these processes are not enough. Some of them violate your own policies, and some of them violate what we consider common law due process that you owe these students here, regardless of any specific law you might point to. These are things you're just expected to do. They've been overturned. There have been some very large settlements. The largest ones I can think of actually involved accused student athletes who can make a claim that their future perhaps in professional competition has been ruined because of these accusations here, sometimes high six-figure settlements. The interesting thing about this is how will Catherine Lehman, if she's confirmed, respond to this body of court decisions. When she was reminded of this at the time, very early on, when some pushback happened, there's pushback coming actually from Republican members of Congress, she would default to say, this is just guidance. We are not pretending that we have a binding regulation here. but there were very clear funding threats to some of the colleges that pushed back a little bit. Princeton was among them. Some of the Ivy League schools actually offered more due process to their students than kind of the typical university a student might go to. And they eventually changed their policies because they were that afraid of getting into a drag-out investigation that could end with them losing federal funding. It's not likely, but the public relations headache from it would easily be more damaging than simply doing kind of a quick settlement and changing their policies. The only people who really pushed back in the university environment were often the law professors at these schools. Harvard is one of them, where several law professors who nobody would mistake for conservatives would tell their administrations, this is not sufficient. You are taking away core protections for students who need to be presumed innocent, who need to have a good defense. This is the exact same thing that we've been arguing about in a criminal context.
Right.
You are accusing students of things that could send them to jail. And crucially, in these proceedings, they could say things that could be admissible in court later if they are prosecuted. You can't simply pretend like this is some little process where they'll get a slap on the wrist. This could actually trail them the rest of their lives.
Yeah, these are really important issues. And you know, it's funny, as I've been talking to some people, and some of the people who are most upset about this now are what I would say traditionally liberals, people who grew up in the ACL movement of the 50s, 60s, and 70s, who are worried, and there's a word that's been used in a lot of my conversations recently by other people, and it's really rung in my ears, which is, we are living in an era where conformity over freedom is becoming a real threat. And I just want to describe what that means. You have to toe the line on how you treat people who identify as transgender. You have to toe the line on how you throw people out of schools for alleged sexual assault without maybe even worrying about the due process. You have to fire or suspend teachers or muzzle students who might want to bring faith into their speech in the public realm. And the last place of conformity has been conformity of narratives. And Dan, you've done some really great work on the Fauci emails. And what you see early in the COVID-19 effort is an effort to force one story, before we knew the truth, before we had really a good sense of it, to force one story into the public and make that reality, regardless of facts and dissent or unresolved issues. Tell a little bit about what you learned about the Fauci emails and what they talk about in censorship and conformity of story in America.
Yeah, what we saw in the Fauci emails was that, very early in the pandemic, there were concerns from prominent, respectable scientists that the COVID-19 virus, the SARS-CoV-2, may have been biologically engineered in some way. That came up very early in a thread in the particular batch of emails of Fauci's that were released. And subsequently after that, there's some kind of odd play there. Very quickly afterwards, Fauci and maybe a dozen other major virologists gather on a conference call,
right,
to discuss the potential origins of the virus, apparently, and where it may have arisen. And the notes of those calls are completely redacted from the emails. You do not see what they discussed, really, what was decided or debated in any way at all. It's pages and pages of redactions. But very shortly thereafter, a number of the scientists that were on that call came out very strongly against the lab leak theory, as we're now calling it, the idea that this virus may have leaked from a lab. And that narrative, that perception, held for pretty much over a year, until the last few months, when a major new attention has been paid to the lab leak theory. And if you brought it up any time over the past year, you were dismissed as a crackpot, just a partisan who was looking for an axe to grind, or worse, a racist who was accusing the Chinese of potentially loosing this pandemic on the world. So you can see in those emails, you kind of see a microcosm of so much of what we see in our discourse today, which is, as you point out, this hardening of narratives where one interpretation, one idea is the only acceptable idea, and if you voice anything else, you are facing, at best, ridicule, and at worst, ruin. And that is enforced through a variety of mechanisms, through social media, through social pressure, through news networks hounding you and coming after you. There's a million ways that these narratives are crystallized and locked in, and that the people who might dissent from them clam up about them. But the end result is really just kind of a sort of singular type of discourse where increasingly very few, and in some cases even one idea is the only one allowed to proliferate.
Wow. Really remarkable. That uniformity of stories is bad because, you know, early in a crisis, whether it's a war or a terror attack or a pandemic, you know, we don't get the full complete picture. And so debate is so important. And one of the things that jumped out at me in this recent reversal of the dispute over how the COVID-19 virus got into the United States was Devin Nunes sent a letter to the intelligence director, Avril Haines, and in it, he devotes something that's very chilling, which is there were intelligence professionals, experts, and analysts who really believed that the Wuhan lab leak theory was viable and that there was real evidence pointing to it, and they were censored, they were muted, they were prevented from sharing that viewpoint with policymakers, and as a result, people were making decisions in America without the benefit of knowing that there was a part of the intelligence community that saw a different outcome. And I think this need and sudden desire to get everything conforming, there has to be one story, one approach, one thing, one size fits all, comes at the expense of really important things like truth, free speech, but also the ability for the intelligence community and policymakers to make good decisions. If you don't know there's a dissent, you can't act on it. And consider it. And I wonder, as you look back in the big picture now, over the next few weeks and months, whether it's school curriculum, due process rights of college students, the ability of big tech to censor, is this larger issue of freedom going to all end up in the courts? Are the courts going to be the ultimate arbiters as Democrats and Republicans, liberals and conservatives battle and have very, you know, very partisan divides between them. Do we, a lot of these issues, are they going to end up and be resolved in the courts? Is that where we should be focusing our attention? Start with you, Greg.
Some of them might go to court. I don't think courts a lot of times want to be involved in this. They see these as cultural issues, especially as it pertains to people speaking individually and kind of arguing and maybe being censored. They are looking probably for people to find other ways to maybe express themselves than to go onto platforms that may be very closely monitoring, right, and censoring. What you often find in court is the judges will say, is there an easier way around this than kind of us devising some big new precedent here? What I would probably say for these people is there's just a lot of culture work to do. If you're concerned about this issue, especially being censored, it kind of helps to go out and do the kind of advocacy to get around the censorship you're doing, unless it's the government doing it. That's kind of the big distinction here. You'll see a lot of people make distinctions between the government telling you what you can and can't say, or kind of pushing you in a different direction, chilling your speech, and then the platforms you communicate on. There's been a lot of innovation, even just since Donald Trump was kicked off of social media, in the space for people to kind of communicate. Maybe those platforms won't turn out to be as robust or as popular as maybe people hope they would be. But I think you're starting to see from other social media companies, they're worried about this reputation of being censors here. They are facing government pressure. I think that's one of the concerns that is not often aired, is that Facebook and Twitter and these others 10 years ago were largely not interested in this business of policing what people could say. But they've been worried over the past several years. But they have lawmakers, usually Democratic lawmakers, saying you need to be more active in stamping out misinformation and hate and bigotry and all this kind of thing. They have a fairly tough road to figure out how do we not become unpopular by censoring so much while also keeping Congress off our backs. It's a hard one to do.
Yeah, it is. It is a challenging one. Daniel, I want to ask you about the courts, and I'm going to throw in another body too, because there's been a lot of activity of state legislatures and governors as well. Florida, Texas taking action against critical race theory, others pushing back on the idea that having a voter ID law is somehow racist. Are the state legislatures another place with the courts that we should be keeping an eye on?
State legislatures and courts have played a major role in you know, advancing or retreating on the culture wars and the legal wars that have sort of sprung up around them. I think they're just as important as the federal level. But I think ultimately my sense is that these decisions, these issues rather, are ultimately going to be decided at the cultural level in a lot of ways. And that's really always been the case in the United States. You know, our courts are hallowed institutions. They're obviously critical features of our justice system and sort of the stability of our society. But when you think about the most, you know, major and consequential court decisions in our history, when you think about Plessy versus Ferguson, when you think about Roe v. Wade, you know, even farther back to some of the worst decisions like Dred Scott, that sort of thing. You know, those decisions were hailed at the time for settling the issues they addressed. You know, and the people who were happy with the decisions would say, "We never have to talk about this again. Let's just move on." And of course, that never happened. And people continue to fight these things out, you know, at the cultural level, amongst each other, and amongst institutions that mediate in between government and you know, the individual citizen. So, you know, regardless of what the courts decide, and the court decisions on these issues are going to be critical. They're not to be dismissed in the slightest. But what will ultimately sort of settle these issues and decide where we go as a culture is what people themselves decide to do, what they're prepared to accept in their institutions, what they're prepared to have their kids taught, the level of discourse and the type of discourse they're prepared to put up with and accept. That's where you're ultimately going to see the coin land, is how people themselves feel. And that may in part be shaped by court decisions, but there's a lot of other Sure. factors that go into it as well.
Yep, the will of the American people often is the greatest shaper of our historical experience. Well, listen, I can tell you one thing. Our listeners today got a great example of why your reporting, yours, Greg, and yours, Daniel, is so important to Just the News. You guys are neutral. You're going after the facts. You're following really important stories, and you do it with an excellence that we're so gracious and grateful to have here at Just the News. I want to thank you for joining the show and for continuing to keep us informed with all of your great reporting.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks, John. Thank you.
All right, guys. Have a good rest of the day. I know they want to get back and break some more news, and I'm sure they're going to do that. We're going to get right back and wrap things up for the day in just a few seconds, right after these commercial breaks. Folks, if you owe back taxes, fair warning, you're not going to like this. The IRS is mailing millions of pay up letters. Millions, I say. Then it's up to the 20,000 new IRS enforcement agents to find you. Why the IRS targets you and not millionaires? Well, because millionaires have tax lawyers. You don't. You'll pay up. Plus interest and penalties. You need Tax Network USA, and you need them now. Tax Network USA has brilliant war room strategies to solve your IRS problems quickly and in your favor. Like a preferred direct line to the IRS, they know which agents to deal with and who to avoid. It's not all bad news for you, because Tax Network USA learned of a special limited time IRS offer. They're willing to waive $1 billion in penalties if you qualify. So schedule your free confidential consultation to see if you qualify for this limited time IRS penalty canceling offer. To do so, call 1-800-245-6000. That's 1-800-245-6000, or visit tnusa.com/justnews. That's tnusa.com/justnews. All right, folks, that wraps up another edition of John Solomon Reports. So grateful you joined. I can't thank you enough for what you do every day to support us by reading, by clicking on ads, by buying the services and the great products of our advertisers. You know them all. Bambi, Kansas City, Steaks, Wild Alaskan, so many incredible players that just bless us with support. And you bless them when you buy them. And when you buy their products and services, you're supporting this show. You're supporting the mission of Just the News. I want to say thank you for listening. Thank you for supporting. And thank you for tuning in tomorrow. Well, we'll have great guests and some breaking news. Stay tuned. I think we're going to have some good scoopy stuff tomorrow. All right, folks, that wraps it up for today. We'll be back tomorrow with another edition of John Solomon Reports, the podcast from Just the News.
there, it's Amanda Head, and I am thrilled to introduce to you my new exciting podcast, Furthermore with Amanda Head, broadcasting weekly from sunny Los Angeles, California, and brought to you by the dynamic Just the News Podcast Network. On this fresh and engaging podcast, I delve into the latest news with a little bit of a twist, exploring the furthermore of every story. But this isn't your typical run-of-the-mill news commentary or politically charged program. I interview a diverse range of guests, including business leaders, entertainers, musicians, educators, experts, politicians, and many influential figures from both the United States and around the world. So why not make your Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays a little more interesting? Tune in on your preferred podcast platform and discover Furthermore with Amanda Head on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. And don't forget to hit that follow or subscribe button and be sure to download the latest episodes. I can't wait to have you join me on this exciting journey.
At Just the News, we break the stories others in the media ignore or are too afraid to tell. We did it on Russia collusion, Hunter Biden, and the security and intelligence failures that preceded January 6th. Our stories have real impact and reach because we stick to the facts. I'm John Solomon. You can help me expand our honest, unvarnished, and unbiased reporting by becoming a premium member at Just the News. You'll get an ad-free experience and exclusive member-only access to events, and you'll be helping us dig up more truth. Join today at justthenews.com/subscribe.